You're listening to an American Theater podcast. American Theater is published by Theater Communications Group, www.americantheater.org.
Welcome to Off Script, American Theater's podcast on all things theatrical. I'm Rob Weinert Kent, the editor-in-chief, and I'm here with...
Russ Demond, managing editor.
And...
Deep Tran, associate editor.
And we have a great show for you today. We are just posting this, and this podcast is part of a package on theater and veterans and war is our theme. It's a great package. And so our guest today with our interview is Maurice DeCall, who's an artist in residence here at TCG, helps run the Veterans and Theater Institute, and helped curate this and edit this issue's stuff. So we'll also talk a little bit about the issue before our interview. And then another week, another criticism controversy. We'll be talking about the blow-up that happened after Big River.
Is Charles Isherwood leaving really a controversy?
Well, controversy, something to talk about. Issues raised.
I
feel like it was one of those rare moments when there was a consensus among...
It opened up a discussion about the value of criticism. I guess it wasn't a controversy, although there's controversial elements to it. We can talk. We won't go there today. And then we'll give recommendations. So let's start off by talking about this March print issue, and our online package up this week is on, we're calling it Theater of War, but it's really focusing on warriors and veterans, service members, plays about their experience and also theater being created with them and with their and for their families, a whole range of topics. And Russ, you worked with Maurice very closely on this. Can you talk a little bit about some of the stories in this issue?
Absolutely, thanks, Rob. So for this issue, we got a nice range of stories here. Obviously, with a topic this big, we couldn't cover it all. So in this case, we really focused on the experience of veterans, both as Rob said, making theater as well as being depicted by theater. So veterans, service members, and how they are involved in drama. So we have one story by an Army veteran, Bart Pitchford, who wrote for us for our international issue last year, May, June. He's got a story about the new canon of plays regarding the military. And he really delves into some of the big plays that come across, and he looks at how often we get veterans and service members associated with PTS and PTSD, mm-hmm. and how he'd like to expand the range of representation there, which is always a great thing.
Right, and to expand the range of topics from absolutely. Basically trauma and what he calls the worst case scenarios. Which are, you know, one of my thoughts as I read this is like, well, that's where drama is. But as he points out, there's, I can't call the quotes in mind. But there's so many other topics related to the military and veterans, which are just as dramatic.
Yes.
And which aren't all about the guy coming back and being a loose cannon and ready to explode at any moment. And, you know, those are stories worth telling, but they're not the only stories. I think he makes a good case. And I can't find the quote, but it's wonderful. And we also have some other stories online that cover other aspects of it. And we talk about those as well.
Sure.
Yeah, yeah.
Back to what we have in print, we also have a story by former managing editor Sarah Hart, where she looks at how veterans are involved in the creative process, both in programs where they're making performance on a low-key level as part of a kind of therapy or way to process what they've gone through, but also as various ways that veterans are involved in just making theater and consulting on it for the general public. So that's a really great piece. Actually, I'm really pleased with everything that we have in this package, but that one's pretty great as well. And of course, our cover story is one by Maurice himself, where he has a big Q&A with Chiara Alegria-Judez and David Rabe, two playwrights who have crafted trilogies involving war, and so we get their perspectives on writing about that topic.
Yeah, and David himself served, and Kiara was in her famous Pulitzer Prize winning play and trilogy. Well, Water by the Spoonful was the one that won the Pulitzer, but their trilogy, the Elliot trilogy, was inspired by her cousin, mm-hmm. Elliot, who served in Iraq. Yeah, so it's a great group of stories. There'll be some more extra online. I wanted just this quote from Bart. I thought was really clarifying, because again, the question as you read through this piece, he looks in particular at a few plays: Nine Circles, Grounded, mm-hmm. and I believe Water by the Spoonful, the Elliot Fugues. I think he looks at those in particular, in addition to referencing others. And my thought throughout this is like, he makes very good points, but isn't this just natural for playwrights to look at the most dramatic, the most lurid, the most like headline grabbing things? Well, he makes a point near the end. He says, in the last decade, we saw increased homelessness amongst military veterans, a medical system that failed some of the poorest former service members, the repeal of Don't Ask, Don't Tell, the official acceptance of women into combat roles, transgender people being able to openly serve, and an increasing chasm in the communication between military and civilian worlds, kind of relevant right now.
Yeah.
As he says, these seem like promising subjects for the stage, like all of those, you know, not that plays have not addressed those ever,
right.
But it just seems like, I think it's natural, because this goes back to the origins of drama. And this is one of the reasons that Brian Dory's in his Theater of War uses plays written by Greeks about war, is that when we're looking and contemplating war on stage, these questions are always going to come up about moral injury, about this trauma of war. That's always going to be a frame through which they're seen, right?
Yeah.
But there's so many other stories to tell other than the archetypal example he gives of the veteran who's come back, who's did something terrible and can't shake it and is having flashbacks. Again, I'm not dismissing that narrative, but as he points out, that's a certain percentage, and that's not the only way to tell a story about war.
Right. Well, that's what I really love about the coverage in this issue, though, because, like, for two reasons, really. For, like, one is because, like, war is so much a part of the American fabric, I would say. Like, in its history, we've been involved in some kind of form of war throughout our 200-year history.
Right.
And but then the thing is, because it's an all-volunteer army now, it's such a remote concept to most civilians. It's something overseas that we digest via whatever... I don't want to say propaganda, but it's a very curated imagery.
Yeah.
And so, like, having veterans write plays, having veterans be in plays, like, it brings these narratives back home to those of us who haven't had to make that kind of sacrifice.
Yeah.
Good. And, like, the second point for me was, like, all these conversations around the NEA and the importance of the NEA, like, veterans doing theater, like, that's a form of art therapy, because it's helping them reacclimate to civilian life.
Right.
And I'm doing this story about a show called The Blueprint Specials, which was recently remounted on the Intrepid in New York City. And it was shows created by veterans, put on by veterans, for veterans. Actually, no, not veterans, but active military service people. And it was a form of art therapy to help them, you know, feel happy and feel like their work had value,
right.
And to, like, get them through their trauma. And so when we're talking about, like, the value of the arts, especially when we're arguing for it in public, like, this is the value of the art.
Right.
Like, it can be used to rehabilitate people. Though, granted, if our leaders really cared about people, then they'd be doing a lot more things.
The Blueprint Specials, that was during World War II, right?
Yeah.
These were created, these works. I think the other point I really liked was in Sarah's, a related point to Bart's, which was, I forget which program she was talking about, but there was one in which veterans were getting up and telling their worst, like, kind of their worst war stories in public. And it was stressful for everyone. It wasn't, it put the veterans through, like, reliving it. And everyone leaving these performances just felt like, oh, God, you know, it's just the most awful thing. And I think what they talked about was really listening to what veterans and service members, what kind of theater they would make and want to make and want to see. It's not just about the trauma and moral injury of the wars. It's often, as the Blueprint Specials indicates, they want to entertain each other. They want to tell stories about what they're doing and who they are and what their lives are like. I mean, and I think that comes through in our coverage.
And that there's a point to what it is that they're doing.
And there's a point too. To it, yeah. And yeah. It's not meaningless. Yes.
Yeah, and of course, storytelling is such a huge part of any culture, and giving people an opportunity to tell their story is one of the many great things about theater. Mm-hmm. And a related point, Kiara talks about how in working on the trilogy, she interviewed her uncle, who had never spoken about his experiences before. And so you get that in the Q&A that Maurice led. And so it relates to.
Well, I love that story because she says, I think she's going to sit down with him and talk about his service in Vietnam or Korea. I don't remember which it was.
Vietnam.
And
yep, he was a Marine.
Her aunt said, you know, he never talks about this. They're like, you don't talk about this.
Yeah.
And so Kiara was nervous.
Yeah.
And she asked him one question, and two or three hours later, he stopped. He opened up and had never.
Yeah.
I get moved just thinking about it because, like, people asking other people just to tell their stories.
Yeah.
Is really powerful.
She threw out her questions because she just came in and asked, when did you enlist? And he talked forever. 3 hours later, he was still going. She says,
it's a great story. As I make the point in my other's note that I feel like it's a familiar. Again, this is not to make this equivalent or dismiss it. We're pretty familiar with the sort of trope or trend of a underrepresented or misunderstood minority mm-hmm. not having their stories told or represented clearly on stage, right. And that one of the best ways to correct that is to reach out to them and have them tell their own stories and enact them. So mm-hmm. I mean, fill in the blank. What we're talking about, and it's a familiar tendency, and also, you know, the solution isn't that hard.
Right. And it's not, and yes, it's uncomfortable, but that's the great thing about it, because mm-hmm. I think like most people don't want to talk to veterans because like they're afraid of like the awkwardness that might entail from having to actually deal with something that's very traumatic.
Oh yes,
or very. Yeah.
That reminds me also that I wanted to say that we've written about this issue many, many times over the years, and we have a bunch of wonderful stories that we're going to be sharing online this week, resharing from previous years about Brian Dory's Theater of War, about KJ right. Sanchez's work with Reentry, about Bryce Pinkham writing the wonderful piece about doing theater at Gitmo for veterans mm-hmm. there, or for service members, active military. So it's an ongoing discussion. I wanted to segue to our next topic. I think, Deep, do you want to set this up? What happened and why are we talking about it?
Sure. So last Tuesday, on Valentine's Day, actually, Laura Collins Hughes of the New York Times wrote a review of the New York City Center Encore's production of Big River. New York City Center, in case for non-New York City listeners, do mostly concert stagings of rarely produced musicals. That's one of the series they put on.
That's Encore's, yeah.
Encore's, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it was a positive review.
It was a positive review, aside from the fact that she questioned the relevance of doing a musical adaptation of Mark Twain's Huckleberry Finn because it marginalizes the voices of the black people within it, and considering our present conversation on race, whether or not this work has anything to add.
Right.
It's the classic question of why this play, why now?
Right.
Exactly.
Right.
Which, you know, we all ask that.
Yes.
Like, as artistic directors, as, you know, people who write about theater, like, why are we doing this?
Yep. Yeah, yeah.
And then the producer of Encores, Jack Fertel, wrote a very heated letter to Laura's editors at the Times saying, I disagree with Laura, and I'm paraphrasing. I disagree with Laura, and I find her review amateurish and she does not understand Mark Twain. And mm-hmm. I question this direction of reviewing that the New York Times is going to go into, putting in, you know, trendy socio-political context that has no relevance to this piece of theater.
Right, right. And then Frank Rich reshared that. I mean, I don't think it was an open letter, but obviously Frank Rich got Jack Fertel's permission to run it on his Facebook page. And Frank approvingly, like, you know, seconded it, basically. Yeah.
And Playbill ran it.
And then Playbill ran it.
Yeah, yeah.
And then Playbill also ran a letter from the New York Times editors to Jack saying the job of the critic is to contextualize the work it's in the period when it's presented, because theater, right. And this quote stood out to me because it just sums up like my ethos on seeing theater, right. Is theater lives and breathes in the moment of its watching.
Yes.
Right.
And so if you don't take into account the audience's participation within this art form, then it's basically a scholastic exercise.
Right.
Which I also agree with. So the reason that this interested me, and I also posted up an article in response to it, were of two things. Like, first were the optics, which was two older white men telling a woman she cannot have this opinion on something. All the personal attacks were very problematic to me. And then the second part was this has been my experience too, which is when you question the validity of a classic or a piece of work that a lot of people love and question it from a viewpoint of it being problematic to today's audiences, there's a subset of people who will then call you something like, you know, the PC police,
right.
Or why does it matter? And why can't you just enjoy this? It's a classic. Why are you questioning a right. classic?
Right. Insert Mikado, insert Taming yeah. the Shrew, and yeah. a bunch of things. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Which is, it's ridiculous for me because if we're not supposed to question this, then why are we in the room with this piece of work? I don't want to say movie, but theater lives because of the interplay between audience and artist.
Right.
And so if you don't want the audience to have an opinion about your work, maybe you shouldn't present it to a live audience. Right.
You know, and then you did a dialogue with Kalundra Smith, one of our regular contributors from Atlanta, who's African American, yeah. because it felt like no major critics of color had weighed in on this, at least not on social media, but not in any published piece. Nicole Sartori wrote a wonderful piece for Exeunt. I think that's how you say
Excellent.
That. Excellent. About it, which I think made similar points about the context. I mean, the only revision I would say, and I think this has been pointed out, I think Jack's letter, and I know Jack and I respect Jack. He wrote a great book about musical theater and what he does at Encores is, but this goes to the heart of it. Encores' mission is to present older works, and they often are having to recontextualize or edit or change. It's both understandable he would be sensitive on this issue, but also, as some have pointed out, like, he should be ready for this conversation because this is what Encores is about, right?
And you're presenting a story about a slave. Right. Like, do you think you're going to put up a story about a slave and not expect to have a conversation on race? That's ridiculous.
I would just add one thing that says theater does live, and I completely agree, in the moments of it lives in the moment and the breath of its watching. But it also is, I think theater is a dialogue with the past in many ways also. Even a new play is because it's a form that's old. And no play springs from nothing. And it's, so I feel like, I think Kalundra made the excellent point in it is that we need to both contextualize where we are now, which we all know where we are now, although we don't agree about where we are now necessarily. We know where we are now, but also to look at the context of where it is. I think if the conversation goes too much in the realm of like, well, this is what Gilbert and Sullivan meant, and you have to look at it in context. Yes, of course you look at it in context. We know it was written then. It's very obvious it was written then because I think Big River is an interesting case because it's, and this is an argument I got into social media a little bit about it, was Big River, I like. I don't love. I love the Deaf West rendition of it. That added another layer of difference and communication to it that I think made
it marginalized voices too.
Yeah, exactly. That the World's Apart number in particular, but also the Waiting for the Light to Shine, the famous moment. Mm-hmm. So that gave it a sort of a fresh resonance. But you know, if I have a criticism of Big River, is that it's all major key. It's all sunny. Yeah. It's all, like literally the music is all. And I love Roger Miller, but it's like, could throw in a minor chord every now and again. So that it typifies, and that's not all of Huck Finn. I mean, the whole argument about Huck Finn has often been about its point of view and its, you know, about its relevance. I mean, there's a lot of Twainsplainers out there, I would say, who are, and I, you know, it's a great work. It's a masterpiece. It deserves to be around. This is Huck Finn I'm talking about. But there is a bit of a tone that people get. It's like the Mikado fans, you know, I'm going to hold up Huck Finn a little higher than Mikado as a masterpiece, but I will say there's people, this is like Shakespeare. Like, this happens with Brecht. It happens with anybody who like knows their stuff. Like, well, you don't get it. You don't get it. It's all a satire, you know? And I think Calendra actually made the point. It was interesting that she says, and I don't know if Big River stresses this enough. I think, the novel is written from the point of view of Huck Finn, who's a very unreliable narrator.
Right.
And so an unreliable narrator, at least explains why other voices are not part of it. And he's a kid. But as Calendra points out, part of the joke of it, part of the satire is that Jim knows much better than Huck Finn.
Yes.
And it becomes clear as you read it that like Jim is much wiser, but we're not going to hear from Jim because it's Huck Finn's awakening story. But so anyway. All which is to say, Big River is in some ways, it's not that old, but it's 30 years old, and has its own flaws as an adaptation of what Mark Twain was about. I think someone else pointed out that Lir Deb Bessonet, the director, made the choice to put African American cast members on stage in numbers they weren't really part of.
Right. Mm-hmm. I noticed that. Yeah.
Now, I should also say that we haven't seen the production. None of us in this room have seen this particular production.
Right.
It was all on stage for four days.
That some people felt like, in a way, she was trying to address the problem, but that actually made it seem more, they seem more marginal than they even do in the narrative already, right? So I don't know. It's hard to say.
And
all of this really speaks to what Marvin Carlson talks about in The Haunted Stage. Where every piece of theater is ghosted by any number of things that came before.
Yeah.
So a work of theater really can't be exactly the way it was when it was first presented. It's a dialogue, as Rob said.
Yeah.
And not only with all productions that came in between and everything that's taken place in between, but also with the history surrounding that first production.
Yeah.
In a way that you can't look at your own moment, but you can look back at the moment when something was first presented.
Right.
And I think like what frustrates me about a lot of the arguments I was seeing online and what I've experienced when I wrote about the Mikado was there's a tendency to put classics in a glass case. Mm. Where you cannot criticize the problematic nature of this work, even though when it was written, like, people of color, women were not even allowed to be in the room to make it.
Right.
So people think, like, it's this thing that is beyond reproach. And then when someone like a woman or a person of color, like today's audience, looks at it, like somehow we're the ones, in Frank Richards' words, like PC policing this piece of work, even
right.
though that is our jobs, that's our right as people who love the theater and who want talk about it.
Right,
and
right,
I think
right.
like there's a tendency to, it's like, I have a problem with a piece of work, and then because I have a problem with it, like, I am the one who is being offensive.
Right.
Instead of having a dialogue over whether or not the merits or not of this piece of work. Like, there is a tendency from people like Frank Rich. Sorry, I'm really mad at Frank Rich right now. There's a tendency for certain people to, like, just not engage. And
right.
just say, you don't know this piece of work, to delegitimize the arguments of people today who are watching it.
Right.
And I mean, that's destructive.
We should point out also, Frank Rich's colleague at New York Magazine, Jesse Green, wrote a much more pointed piece. In fact, the whole thesis of his piece was that there's a reason we won't see this play on Broadway again. Whereas Laura's was, I think Calendra pointed this out. If anything, it was sort of like such a mild objection, it almost was an afterthought, you
right.
know?
Exactly, yeah.
Although the headline made it sound like, I think, if I can't remember the headline, but the headline really foregrounded
the question,
whereas like her lead headline. Was all about how great the performances were and how much fun the show was, other than this one aspect. I don't know. We could talk even more about this. I think it's an ongoing discussion. I think one of the backdrops that people pointed out is that with Charles Isherwood gone, who they replace this with and what direction the criticism takes is a big question, and it sort of shadows any discussion of it, you know, criticism of a Times review. That's not by Ben Brantley, who's not going anywhere. So that also has to go into the mix. I think that, as we talked about last podcast, the job description that they listed for the next staff critic was very encouraging on that front in terms
yes.
of engaging with the world and engaging with the ideas outside the theater and the contemporary, as well as, you know, the literature of theater. I mean, I'm always trying to look at the bridge between the two, between the past and the present. But I think if you leave any of those, if you leave both, either of them out, you're not getting the whole picture.
Exactly.
Right?
Exactly. And I think like there's a tendency to like leave one of these things out when we're discussing classics.
Yeah.
And it doesn't do it. What, like Calendar made a good point. Like the reason it's a classic is because it holds up.
Yeah.
And so does this hold up?
Right.
That's a question we're allowed to ask.
I think it is. Well, we will continue asking that. And how would you set up our interview with Maurice, which we're going to go to now?
Maurice is a former Marine
yeah.
and artist in residence at Theater Communications Group. And he did a valiant job in guiding us toward the coverage that we should include in this issue, as well as what we mentioned before, leading the Q&A.
It was great to sit down with Maurice. I tell you, he's worked here for about a year, maybe a little yeah. less than a year. And we've thought since we came here, we want to sit down with this guy and talk about his background, why he became a Marine, why he stopped becoming a Marine, where art came in, and what he does now for the theater. So it's a great conversation. Hope you enjoy it. Well, hey, Maurice. How are you?
I'm good, Rob.
Maurice DeCall is our TCG Artist in Residence, our first Artist in Residence. In our history, as far as I know. And your role here, describe your role, your title, your role at TCG.
Sure. So the title is the TCG Artist in Residence. And, you know, I think the way that I'm seeing that is what I'm doing is we're trying to help build the Veterans in Theater Institute. Mm-hmm. And what the Veterans in Theater Institute is, it's this new program funded by the Doris Duke Charitable Foundation, with the hope of building demand in the arts, right? For us specifically, we're looking at theaters. And by building demand, we wanted to work with military and veteran communities and build demand in theater by involving folks as theater makers in the process, right? So we teach folks how to write plays. We teach people how to work in technical theater.
Right.
We wanted to do a deep engagement and not have this be a marketing exercise. Just
yeah, no, like, get some more butts in the seats. It's not about
it's
that.
It's not about
no,
that.
No,
it's about getting people into the theater as makers, as playwrights, right? And as technical theater people.
Right.
Eventually, I imagine, you know, that people will keep coming and they'll bring their friends and families and they'll come and see the shows. But for us, building demand was slightly different. Again, it's not a marketing thing. It's about deep engagement with a community that I would imagine doesn't always come to the theater for a lot of different reasons. But we have some assumptions that we're working on there.
So I know the Blue Star programs goes back a number of years. Was the ground seeded for you beforehand, or was it really, were you pushing on an open door, or was there a lot of challenges to build this up?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think nationally there are several of these sorts of programs already existing.
Mm-hmm.
So my own background here in New York, I started writing at a similar workshop at New York University. It started in 2008. I started with them the academic year 9-10. And what they do is they teach playwriting and fiction, prose. Poetry.
Poetry,
and
right.
prose. And prose.
Okay. And prose.
So that's one. And there are several in New York. And there are others that do similar things around the country. So there are existing programs. What we did is shifted a little bit, and instead of teaching poetry and prose, we're teaching playwriting.
Okay.
So, yeah, it's not necessarily a lot of, how did you phrase it? Open door?
Yeah, like in other words, like there's a movement and a scene out there for you to sort of plug into. You have to also do some generative work and create links that aren't there, right?
Right. That's sort of what we're doing now, is trying to find our partners in the community, people who we can work with.
Okay.
So whether they be veterans in Providence, we're working with the Providence Community Libraries, right? They donate space to us so we can actually teach the workshop there. We work with Trinity Rep Company there as well. But yes, there has been over the years several of these programs open. So when we talk with people, this is not a new thing for them.
Right. Okay.
What's new is that we are teaching playwriting and technical theater.
Okay.
And not necessarily poetry.
That's the poetry. Now, so I want to ask about you specifically. I want to ask first the sort of two-pronged question. Mm-hmm. What drew you to the Marines?
Oh.
And then what drew you to poetry and expressing yourself as a writer?
Sure. The Marine Corps question is a complicated question. It goes back to, I think maybe when I was about 4 years old.
Four? Wow.
Yeah. It goes back a long time.
Wow.
So my family were from the Caribbean, from an island called St. Vincent. It's a small island due west of Barbados, just a little bit north of South America. So not far from Trinidad and Venezuela.
Tobago. Yeah, exactly.
Sure. So in order to come to the United States, we had to get visas. We had to get visas to travel here, to emigrate here. So my father and I flew from our island to Barbados to get those visas. That's where the American consulate is. Mm-hmm. And my memory, 4-year-old, there was this Marine standing there. And I remember seeing that person. And I've always just really been interested in the military in general.
Yeah.
But as I grew older, as I read a lot. You know, my father, he bought us an encyclopedia, so I just read that.
Yeah.
So I read that and also read a lot of memoirs and books of nonfiction about the military. Started to really identify with the Marine Corps because, you know, if you start thinking back to World War II specifically, these amphibious landings onto contested beaches, right?
Yeah, yeah.
So, for example, Iwo Jima. You have a Marine Division landing on a beach. There's an entrenched, I think, 20,000 Japanese. There is no fallback, mm-hmm. except to push forward and win the engagement, right? You can't go back into the ocean.
Right, right.
For me, that was really interesting. That, you know, there's this mission that the Marines were given, and there is no, you know, there is no option but to accomplish it.
Okay.
So that really spoke to me. And I read a lot about World War II and also then Vietnam, and grew up during the time of the Gulf War. Mm-hmm. So I remember just observing the way that the Marine Corps operated at that time, and just fascinated by it. I was also really interested in aircraft.
Okay.
I at one point thought I might go into engineering.
Okay.
So I read a lot about aircraft, and I knew how they work. I know how they work. I knew this is like a 10-year-old, right?
Yeah, sure.
I knew pretty much everything about all the U.S.-made military aircraft, and also the Soviet, there was still Soviet Union at that time.
Oh, yeah. So you were in that generation.
Yeah. So it was just an interest. Mm-hmm. So growing up and then going to high school, I think at that time, the plan was just to finish high school mm-hmm. so I can join the Marine Corps.
Yeah. Okay.
So I knew from a long time that I was going to join the Marines. And I'm not going to say that every Marine knows that, you know, he or she is going to be a Marine from when you're a child. That's crazy.
But
I
think not a lot of them, but some of them.
Some of them do. I think a lot of them do.
And it was always the Marines. It was you, that, specifically that division.
There's a flirtation with the Rangers.
Okay.
When I got into high school. And I think it's similar because both groups operate similarly. It's a mindset.
Well, they do set themselves apart in a way,
they
right?
They do.
From the sort of institutional Army, Navy.
Yeah.
Right? Yeah.
So I thought about that for a little bit. But I think in my heart, I always wanted to be a Marine more than anything else. In terms of the military. So I had to join the Marine Corps. I think I would have regretted it if I had not joined the Marine Corps.
Now, you mentioned you grew up around the time of the Gulf War, but when you enlisted, were we in active combat at the time?
Yeah, it's a good question. I think the United States is oftentimes involved in some sort of military activity.
Sure.
We have large MOOTWAs, military operations other than war.
There's a whole acronym for that. Yeah. Okay. Wow. I didn't know that.
Yeah. So like the first Gulf War is a MOOTWA, right? It's not a declared war. It's an operation.
Oh, the first Gulf War. Really? Yeah. All these operations are those wars?
Yeah. Technically.
Okay.
I mean, no, technically I don't believe they are because we didn't declare war. You can't declare war on terror. It's an idea.
Oh, so, sure. Well, there's that. Yeah.
So they're MOOTWA. Yeah. So there's a military operation of the war. So we oftentimes are involved in, you know, MOOTWAs. So Iraq and Afghanistan are huge, you know, large operations in which millions of people have been involved. But then you have smaller ones. You have Kosovo, and this is answering your question, which began for us in, I think, 93, 94, and then went all the way to 2004, happening in the background.
Right, okay.
There's that. There are, this is, I think, public knowledge now. In the Philippines, there has been a constant engagement with Abu Sayyaf, which is a local Al-Qaeda-like affiliate group in the Philippines. But that there's been an engagement with them since the Gulf War.
Oh, really?
So there's always a conflict happening somewhere. of course, again, they're the big ones like the Gulf War where you mobilize 500,000 plus troops, and then these smaller ones. So, yes.
So, when you came into it?
I joined in 97.
So, you weren't one of these. Yeah, you weren't someone who enlisted after, say, 9/11 or.
No. Right. This is prior.
Prior.
But when I joined the Marine Corps, I went to boot camp July 6, 1998. And about a month and a half into boot camp, I think I was on a rifle range. The American embassies in Kenya and Tanzania were bombed.
Okay, yes.
So at that moment, drill instructors, they put this in your head, but it's not true.
Yeah.
That once you leave here, you're going to go to war. You're not trained enough to go to war.
Yeah, right.
But they do tell you things like that.
Yeah.
And,
to get you ready.
To get you ready. Yeah,
sure.
So remember being on a rifle range. I think I was on a rifle range. And that happening, and things become very real.
Yeah, yeah.
Because the embassies have been blown up. Hundreds of people have been killed. This is a real thing.
Right.
And then 2000, I think it was 2000, the USS Cole was bombed. And this is all these things are Al-Qaeda.
I remember, this building up to 9/11. I remember this was looking back. I know there are a lot of Marine stations. I mean, the Marines died in 83 in Beirut. Mm-hmm. Is that right?
Correct.
There was a bombing there. Is that, are the Marines usually stationed around embassies, or is that just more often? So, or, yeah.
The embassy, the Marine security guards are stationed at American embassies around the world.
Okay, yeah.
And I believe there are 3 or 4 battalions of MSGs is what we call them in the Marine Corps. And they are at the embassies. The people who died in Beirut, a lot of them came from Charlie Battery 110. I was in Bravo Battery 110. So they're a sister unit of ours. So we remember those Marines.
Right.
They weren't necessarily, I don't know if their job is, I don't know. I could be wrong here, but I'm not sure if their job was embassy reinforcement, which is a mission that you sometimes get.
I think they might have been there in relation to other conflicts in the region.
Yeah.
There was quite a number of them, 183.
Oh, it was more. It was 200.
200, yeah. It was a large number.
Yeah, the whole battery.
So I wonder about, I think we'll revisit some stuff about your military career and background, but I wanted to know then, were you always interested in creativity along the way? Was that something that afterwards you wanted an outlet?
No, I was not at all. I mean, people ask. I'm starting to learn how to write fiction now.
Okay.
And that's a new thing for me. Because growing up, I read the encyclopedia.
Right.
Did not read novels.
You just read, nonfiction.
Things.
Yeah, right. Facts.
No interest at all in the arts. None. I mean, when I got out of Marine Corps, I thought I was going to be a police officer. I had applied to the NYPD, taken a test. I was well on my way to being a police officer. I think I was waiting for a psych eval, and then I would have been on, in the academy. But then we got activated, went to war.
Right.
So that got put on hold for
a while. Oh, I see. Okay.
Yeah. So, no, I wasn't thinking about the arts. The arts actually came, maybe by accident. That's a way of thinking about it. So I had gotten out of, the Marine Corps, went back to college. I was at Columbia. That's where I did my undergrad. And in 2008, we, veterans, had started organizing to ask for a new GI Bill.
Okay.
A GI Bill that would be reminiscent of the GI Bill that, our predecessors in World War II in Korea had.
Right, right.
One that would pay for college, one that would pay a living stipend.
Right.
And one would pay for books, et cetera, et cetera. So we lobbied for that. And between 2008 and 2009, we were waiting to see whether or not the bill was going to be signed into law. So I didn't want to waste any benefits while I waited for the new chapter, what is it, chapter 30, the new GI Bill, let's just call it that.
Right.
Let's call it today, to go into effect. So I took a year off from school. At Columbia, you could take 3 years off. I took a year. And decided to, I was working, but I needed something to do on the weekends. I needed something to keep myself busy and found this writing workshop at NYU. And I thought it was prose, and it was, it was fiction, which was no interest.
Yeah. Okay.
And poetry. And I also didn't see the value in that at the time. But what changed is the person who was teaching the workshop. Her name is Lauren McClung. She's still at NYU. I believe, yeah.
Lauren McClung?
McClung?
McClung.
McClung.
Okay. Oh, McClung. Yeah, I've heard this name. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
So I think she's still there.
Yeah, yeah.
And she brought in poems by Yusuf Komunyakaa. I'd never heard of Yusuf. And Yousaf's a Pulitzer Prize winning American poet. He's the New York State Poet Laureate currently.
Okay.
And senior poet in residence at NYU.
Okay.
He's also a Vietnam vet, a Bronze Star recipient. And she brought in his work, and I started reading his work. And I saw some things in Yousaf's work that made sense to me, some things that I could identify with. Mm. And it was the way that he was approaching his subject matter. So there's one of his poems called Starlight Scope Myopia. And basically what's happening in that poem is the soldiers are on an ambush patrol, and they're looking through, this is Vietnam, so starlight scopes, mm-hmm. down into a valley, and below them there are, I don't know if they're VC or Vietnamese Army, but there are, you know, enemy combatants down below in the valley. And you're watching these people move things, right? And, you know, the poem is, the color of the poem is like the MBG green. I know what that looks like. I've been, not in that particular position, but I've looked at people in MBGs at night. So I knew what that looked like.
Night vision goggles, just to spell that.
Night vision goggles.
Lay people, yeah. Gotcha, yeah.
So I could identify with his work. And then it was just about trying to figure out how to mimic it.
Okay.
And that's how it all started. It was Lauren bringing in Yousaf's work and that poem. And just trying to figure out, how did he do this? And then seeing myself in it. And then over the reading Yousaf's work, all of it, still reading his work, mm-hmm. I could identify with it on many different levels.
Did this open up a channel for things that you couldn't say other ways, or feelings or things that you felt a need to express? Or it sounded like it was also just a craft and identification, like you identified with it and mm-hmm. says, and you wanted to figure out how to do it. And it's sort of like, you know, like an engineer mind, like, how do I do that?
Yeah.
But was there also an emotional and, you know, connection that you had?
Yeah, it brought it out of me.
Yeah, it brought it out of you.
When I first came back up until, this is 2009, came back from Iraq in 2003, I didn't drill with my unit. So I was in the reserves, this unit here in New York, 2nd Battalion, 25th Marines on Garden City. It's a weapons company. It was a mortarman with them, had a gun team of my own. But when we came back, I transitioned out of the Marine Corps.
Okay.
And I lost track and contact with a lot of those Marines. Mm-hmm. So, you know, there was no one to actually talk about these stories with, except in Seamus. I worked with a guy named Seamus. He was a Marine. So we would tell stories to each other. He served in the first Gulf War. Right. But, you know, outside of Seamus, never really talked about the war mm-hmm. until I got to NYU. In that room were other vets of Iraq and Afghanistan, mm-hmm. people around my age.
Yeah.
Most people had just come back. These people are still my friends today. We're still all hanging out. But, I was reading their work. I was identifying with it, and we became friends first.
Right.
That's what happened.
Okay.
And, so it did, just two things happened. I made friends with these people. We could tell our war stories. And then I didn't realize that I needed to tell these stories.
Right.
Until
right.
I started writing them down.
Okay.
And I was actually talking with someone this weekend, yesterday. Another person who runs an arts organization for vets.
Right.
Down in Florida, like I was mentioning to you earlier.
Yeah, Florida, yeah.
Yeah. And she was saying to me now, you know, cause she's starting to learn how to write poetry and how to write plays. She's doing the same thing I was doing years ago, which is writing 5 or 6 poems a day. Cause you just need to get the stuff out of your body, out of your mind.
Yeah.
So that's what happened. I was trying to figure out how to do it.
Yeah.
And then I realized, oh, I actually need to purge this. You need to do it.
Okay, yeah. It's interesting. There's a lot of things that you brought up that I want to touch on, because there's some of the stories in this wonderful special issue mm-hmm. that you co-curated, deal with this idea that the stories need to be told.
Yeah.
And that there's no outlet in many ways, not just to tell amongst yourselves, but to share with the outside world. So it's like understand. I think it's especially acute now that our wars are fought by a volunteer and mm-hmm. a tiny percentage mm-hmm. that I almost think of it. It's not a perfect analogy, but I think of our service members as a minority. It's mm-hmm. not represented, and it's often caricatured and misunderstood on our stages. Sounds familiar, right? For a lot of other minority underrepresented voices. And that's some of the best ways to connect with an authentic voice is to either have veterans write that or have testimony from them. Mm-hmm. And that's what a lot of the theater we've covered, KJ Sanchez's work.
Yeah.
The other thing that's really interesting is the Q&A that you moderated between mm-hmm. Kara Alegria-Hudez, mm-hmm. who's the relative of a veteran, and David Rabe, who's a Vietnam veteran himself, yeah. who both wrote, you know, kind of definitive, if that's the right word to use, but mm-hmm. certainly iconic plays about the different generations of veterans in mm-hmm. different wars. And the contrast between those... In Kiara's play, Elliot Soldier's Fugue, she makes a direct link
yeah.
between the veterans of the different wars and the ways in which they don't express themselves.
Yeah, right.
I wondered if you could talk about that, since Yusuf was a Vietnam veteran. Mm-hmm. Do you feel like there are common themes, or there are definitely differences among the generations of veterans?
Well, I think both.
Right.
So I'll talk about a friend of mine. His name is George. Mm-hmm. And this is in reference to something that's very different.
Yeah.
Korean War era Marine.
Yeah.
Served up until the last day in Korea. That's the day he was wounded. It was the last day in Korea.
Last day. Okay.
He was a infantryman. And his story, what he told me is up until the last minute of the last day, the Marines and the Chinese were both trying to, gain land, gain territory. So the conflict was going up until the last minute.
Okay.
So the Chinese that they were fighting, machine gunned the wire, the communications wire, and he was tasked with going out and fixing it. He did that three times.
Okay.
Because they kept machine gunning the wire, and he kept going out to fix it, and then he eventually got shot.
Okay.
What he said to me one day, we were having breakfast, and I love talking to these older vets, because they have, yeah. you know, incredible story. I'm not even talking about that story. It's what he said to me that morning. But then the war ended. And I just didn't understand what George meant. I mean, I really didn't understand the concept of the war ending.
Okay.
It's like, at this time, we stopped shooting each other. At this time, we allowed them to pick up the bodies of their fallen comrades, and they allowed us to do that. Mm. I don't understand what I have no concept, because our wars...
They don't stop.
They don't stop. They transform.
Right.
But they don't stop. I mean, we're not finished in Iraq. We're still there. It's just, it's transition. It's in a new
form. Just pull some people out and, but it keeps, yeah.
We still have thousands of troops in Iraq. We have aircraft that are flying missions all the time. Whether they be piloted by people mm-hmm. or remotely piloted. I mean, this is still an ongoing war.
Yeah.
Afghanistan is the same thing. Mm-hmm. Yemen, you saw it a couple of days ago with this Navy yeah. SEAL that was killed. Mm-hmm. So they don't end. They've just transformed. So when George said that to me, it blew my mind. Because he literally said at the time that was appointed, we stopped shooting each other. No concept.
Wow.
No concept.
Yeah, I wonder. It does seem like there's those two wars between, or after World War II, which was a giant civilizational conflict.
Yeah.
And then you had Korea and Vietnam. Just to overgeneralize and think out loud here those were sort of, I mean, Korea was called a police action, I yeah. think, right? Yeah. And Vietnam was sort of backed into over, mm-hmm. over many, many years, right?
Yeah.
And it eventually was a full on war.
Yeah.
But it was still, there's a difference even then between those wars and then the modern engagements, which are mm-hmm. meant to be short. Mm-hmm. And again, as I say, have this small percentage of Americans actually fighting.
Yeah.
But there's something about that lends them to being attenuated and not being like, here's the official beginning, here's the official end, here's mm-hmm. we sign a treaty and it's over. It's just, it seems like it's an old model of
yeah.
warfare, right?
I mean, the last time we saw a war come to an end,
yeah.
The first Gulf War, where the combatants came together in Kuwait, signed a treaty.
That's true,
yeah. Very limited conflict. I think what is interesting about that particular conflict
yeah.
in regards to the two that we're in right now, because we're yeah. still in Afghanistan, still in Iraq, this war on terror, right? Vietnam and Korea, is the scope of the mission was clearly defined.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
The scope of the mission was to remove the Iraqis from Kuwait, not yeah. to follow them into Baghdad.
Yes,
just to remove them.
Right, right, right.
And once that was accomplished, once that very clearly defined mission was accomplished, the war came to an end.
Yeah.
It did not come to an end necessarily. Like the ground combat, the force on force came to an end, then the war transitioned a little bit.
Yeah.
Because then you had the air.
Yeah, because Kurds, the Kurdish no-fly area.
The no-fly right? zones in the north and the
right,
south.
Right, right, right.
But the force on force conflict, just, you know, ground forces.
Right. So that might have been one of our last in that model, at least until the, wow.
Reading Youssef's work and reading some of the other Vietnam era, for me, it goes back to poetry. That was my first parlay into writing. What I see is, you know, like sometimes the opportunity to... So he has another poem, can't remember the name of it right now, in which the soldiers are given some R&R time, right? And they go to the beach and they play volleyball and they grill and they do all these things. And then he has a moment, the poet does, or Yusuf does, where he steps back and he watches everything happening. And he thinks about, this is him now thinking years in the future about something that's happened in the past. That guy who just like caught, who just hit the volleyball in 2 days steps on a landmine.
Yeah.
I think in those ways, the wars are still very similar. At the end of the day, regardless of whether or not we're fighting clearly defined wars or these open-ended conflicts, human beings are engaged in extreme acts of violence, killing, and the consequences of that on both sides, and especially with the civilian population.
Yeah.
So in those ways, it's I think very it's similar. It's still brutality, regardless of how we define whether it's a mutwa or declare war or whatever.
See, now that leads me to one other question I had, which was Bart Pitchford has a really interesting essay, a critical essay about, and this is touched upon in Sarah's piece and a little bit in your dialogue with Kiara and David as well, the idea of a sort of a trope of moral injury and and post-traumatic stress, that seems to be the frame which a lot of people see all veteran experiences through.
Yeah.
And part of that's just like, well, that's dramatic, right? That's that's juicy. It's interesting, right? Yeah. But also, I mean, Bart makes the point that doesn't represent all of veterans' experiences. And I just wonder if you could talk a little bit about, you know, we're talking about fighters of wars, and we're talking about killing and death, but not everyone brings back the same kind of, like, you know, PTS or flashbacks. Or can you talk a little bit about that, Maurice? I mean, I don't want to pry into your own situation necessarily, but I wondered if when you see veterans portrayed, can you tell, like, well, they're just going on relying on the old trope of.
Yeah, I mean, the tropes are there. I definitely see them. See them when I go to the, you know, the theater or and see some plays or the movies or even in books.
Yeah.
I think, you know, some people do come back with problems. I think there's some truth to that.
Yeah.
In terms of like moral injuries, I think it's easier to receive a moral injury if one does not believe in the conflict that one is involved in.
Yeah.
So, for example, you know, these current wars, Iraq, right? If going into it, you have in the back of your mind that this is not a worthwhile excursion.
Yeah.
And you're asked to do things that in a different context you would not mind, you know, will do.
Yeah.
That could be damaging to the individual. That being said, you know, I do know plenty of people who come back. Around vets all the time who are high functioning and run organizations, you know, MFAs and MPAs and PhDs. And
right.
So I think both are true.
Right.
I think both are true. I think what Bart was saying in that piece is that we need to, as we're writing, thinking about writing and the sort of pieces that we're writing, sort of plays that we're writing, to write more. Because Russ and I actually just looked at this because we wanted to make sure that the language was good. And I was concerned about the word more, whether or not it was in there, and it wasn't there.
Okay, right, more. Because, in other words, Bart was saying we need stories about, you know, there's been the repeal of Don't Ask, Don't Tell. There's so many other issues to talk about in terms of military and service than just
this one. This is an important one.
The shell-shocked or PTSD person going crazy.
This is an important one. And people have been writing about this going all the way back.
For millennia, exactly. I mean,
we talked about Brian and the work he's doing with Theater of War.
Yeah.
That's when people have been writing about that, I think, since we've been writing. I remember Paula Vogel one time saying to us, the very first stories that were written down were stories about war.
Of course.
So this has been, this is something that humans are going to write about.
Yeah.
But I think Bart makes a really insightful comment when he says we need to write not plays about, don't repeal, don't ask and tell, or, you know, the other kind of, but write more of them.
Yeah, yeah,
right. I think that's important.
Because, I think the concern there was that he was saying that none had been written. Of course, there's plays about all different sorts of things.
Yeah.
But it's true that these plays that are about the trauma of war, just to generalize about it, are the ones that take up most of our attention. Just in the same way, again, it's an understandable, we're interested in violence. I mean, our stories, whether it's a serious story or an escapism, you know, there's the number of guns you see in posters. As a dad, it's making me anxious, you know, just how much they just put someone with a gun in a poster just to sell tickets, you know?
Yeah. The video games.
The video games. Yeah. Totally. You're a father of sons, right?
Yeah. I do. Exactly. They're not allowed to play those games.
Well, good. No single shooter games, right? Yeah, of course.
Absolutely not.
Yeah.
We can play, you know, Madden or whatever.
But yeah, Mario Kart or whatever. That's what my kids are doing anyway.
But I just want to make sure I answer that question.
Sure.
I think there are a range of ways that people experience and then process the wars. The tropes exist for a reason.
Yeah.
Right? It's not as though, you know, some people don't come back and they are traumatized.
Yeah.
And I think, I don't know, I'm not a specialist in this, but I think maybe trauma operates on different levels. And some of us are, and some people are able to process it quicker or differently.
Right.
And don't manifest it in certain, you know, in the ways that we think about. So, yeah, that being said, there's a range of responses to combat. I think the biggest problem is when you don't believe in what you're doing, that is going to give you troubles.
Yeah.
If you are, spoke to some of these Marines. If you're a Marine who fought in World War II, fighting, you know, in the Pacific against the Japanese, and you know, speaking to some of these guys, absolutely brutal war, in which, you know, very clearly for them, very clearly defined enemy. The ones that I know understood what they were doing and are okay with it.
Right.
Yeah.
I mean, I guess the stereotype I have is that whether you agreed with it or not, it's your job to serve. And then once you're there in the trenches, so to speak, not the trenches anymore, but it becomes about you and us and them. And you just, there's a solidarity that happens whether or not you believe in the larger structure because they're shooting at you and you have no choice just but to defend your buddies. And there's a...
See, this is interesting. Yeah. So I was in the Marine Corps, right?
Yeah.
And do think like that.
Yeah.
But I remember talking to a friend of mine who was in Special Forces.
Okay.
And it just, when he said this to me, it just really dawned on me how differently we had been trained.
Yeah.
So here's a scenario that he gave me. And this is something that happened to him in Iraq. They're driving up and down this road, same road. They have to drive it all the time. And they keep receiving, small arms fire. He said to me, what would you do? I said, well, I'm a Marine. I mean, I'm going to behave like a Marine behaves. We're going to stop the vehicles. We're going to engage the fire. We're going to destroy it.
Right.
That's what we're trained to do.
Right.
I didn't have to think about that.
Yeah.
That's what we're going to do. Yeah. We're going to stop the vehicles. We're going to destroy the house.
Yeah.
So, So what did you do?
Yeah.
He said to me, well, what we did is we stopped the vehicle, walked over to the house, knocked on the door, and said, why are you shooting at us?
Really?
Yeah. Blew my mind. Right? And the person who was shooting at them, the special forces guys, said, well, you know, I'm being paid. They're paying me to do this, so I'm employed by them.
Wow.
And what my friend said, this is the deal they worked out with these folks. I understand that you're being paid by Al-Qaeda to shoot at us. That's fine. Continue to do that. Just put it over our head. Don't put it into our vehicle. If you put it into our vehicles, you'll give us no option but to put it back into you know, your houses. But so long as you put it over us, we're good. We're good? We're good.
Wow. Mind blown. That's
so I think mind blown.
Yeah.
That's not the way we were trained.
Of course not. Of course not. What I'm just trying to figure out, like, if a whole war could be negotiated that way, so that your side could do the same. Like, well, yeah, we're shooting at them. Really, we are.
Put it over our heads. If you can do that, we understand.
Right.
So, you know, do we have to do what I would have done? And that, no.
Hmm.
But that's the way that you're trained to operate.
It depends on the training. Yeah.
Depends on the training.
Hmm. Yeah. And Marines definitely are. I mean, the stereotype is they're all in. Like they.
Oh no, you certainly are. No, you're all in.
Wow.
Yeah.
Bringing this back to the work that Veterans Theater Institute is doing, if we talked about the range of responses people have and the range of outcomes for veterans, do you feel like you see this the work of creating theater with them as a sort of, I mean, people talk about it as therapy, but I mean, it's even just in a more broad sense. Do you feel like it's giving communities this chance to do what poetry did for you, which is an outlet for things that they don't have an outlet for otherwise?
Yeah, we don't think of what we're doing as therapy. We're not therapists. We're not
therapists.
Yeah, yeah. Right? I mean, people do that.
There is a specific thing. Yeah,
the NEA is doing that right now.
Right, right.
I think our program and their program, I think they're complementary to each other.
Right.
Because we don't do therapy.
Right.
But that being said,
yeah,
as we were doing our theory of change, right, which is trying to figure out what activities are going to lead to certain outcomes, which are going to lead to the ultimate, impact, we've realized that there's a potential for people to receive a therapeutic value from what we're doing.
Right, right.
So that's an outcome along the way to the impact of building demand.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So in the workshops, in the classes, I run it the same way that we would run an MFA workshop.
Right.
All right. So people are sometimes given assignments, not always. They're reading a play, at least a play a week. This week we're going to be reading two. Come in, discuss the play, bring work in, talk about the work. Treat it just like you treat any other student. They're not treated any differently. The vets are not.
Right.
And they're not there for therapy. They're there in the right place.
Yeah, of course. Of course. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
They're not, that's why they're.
I guess what I'm saying more, therapy is a shorthand for sort of saying just the impact or benefit of it. It's an outlet again for,
stories. We certainly recognize that there's a possibility for that and it's built into our thinking.
Right.
But it's not our ultimate goal. To have this be therapeutic. I know that it's possible.
Right.
I've seen it. I've lived through it. But it's not the, if that makes sense.
Yeah, sure. Yeah. Sure. And I wonder if anyone has the impulse of, when they're writing about war, to do it justice, the experience of the people who fight it, to do the justice to their experience, but also to this is something I was raised on. Mm. Sort of basically anti-war classics that were basically their intention was to let young people know war is not fun.
Yeah.
War is terrible. and do you feel like that there's, and of course that doesn't stop people from doing wars or enlisting. And of course, yeah, I mean, I'm not even sure that it should, but do you feel like there's that impulse is behind also portraying it, you know, portraying the reality of it? Is it sort of like, let people know what war is really like?
I think so. I think it depends on the writer.
Yeah, yeah, sure.
But this weekend, for example, I was in Florida, I was in Tampa, and I got to see a group from Miami called Combat Hippies. Very strange thing, right?
Combat Hippies?
Yeah. I asked them where they got the name, and what they told me is they had all been out, some of them Marines, some were in the Army, been out of the military for a while, had grown out their facial hair.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Okay. So they looked like hippies and they were wearing like Birkenstocks.
Okay.
So they were deemed to be combat hippies.
Combat hippies.
They're all combat vets.
Sure.
But, so they did an excerpt from their show. I got to see it. And it starts out with one of the members of the group, a guy named Drew, ends up, you know, we're in the same unit. It's just a small world, talking about this crazy question that I don't think I've ever been asked, but that people claim to have been asked. Have you killed anyone? And he goes in. Yeah, I don't think I've ever had that question asked me, but people, you know, people talk about it.
Yeah.
But that being said, he starts by addressing that question. The piece started by addressing that question. And it had me thinking of when I saw him performing his monologue, Tim O'Brien's The Things They Carried.
Oh,
that story within the book where he talks about the veracity of war stories.
Yeah.
Because the body count kept getting bigger and bigger.
Right.
But the volta, the turn on that was when he said, because everyone was laughing, because you can see what he was doing. He's like, yeah, it killed 10 people.
Yeah.
And it ends up with it being 40. And everyone's laughing because it's so ridiculous. And the turn is, but none of this is funny.
Yeah.
And then he starts telling you why it's not funny. And then the story starts expanding.
Right.
I'm not going to claim that their piece is not as anti-war. I don't know what their intentions are.
Right.
But seeing something like that, written by four combat vets, two Marines, two soldiers, very raw piece. I would walk away thinking, I think that's the purpose, to make you think. This is coming from their personal experiences.
Right.
I think, you know, the people I know, a lot of them were writing into, I think, a similar space where you just try to render the war as honestly as you can. And, people make their own, judgments.
Right.
Yeah. And some are going to read it as anti. I mean, I've had work of mine deemed to be anti-war. Not saying it is or isn't.
Yeah, but, sure, sure.
So, hope that answered your question.
Yeah, no, definitely. It reminds me of the Sticks and Bones example with I think David Rabe, who did serve in Vietnam, is among the many who, you know, was not in favor.
Oh, yeah.
At least in retrospect. And his play seems to be designed to confront people with that reality. Maurice, it's great to finally talk to you at length.
Yeah,
And it's a wonderful issue you helped us put together. And hopefully, as I say, these special issues we do on themes are not the last word on the subject. So hopefully it's the beginning of a rich conversation.
I hope so. And, you know, I hope that we're able to see more of these sorts of works and a broad representation of the military veteran and family experience.
Right, right. The home front.
The
right?
home front.
Yeah.
I'm personally curious to see more of those types of works. Because, and you did mention, Rob, that the military is the people who are part of it.
Mm-hmm.
Active Guard Reserve. It's a very small part of our population.
Yes.
Still millions of people, but it's, you know, small. But the families, exponentially, we're talking about tens of millions of people who have to deal with what it's like, you know, when someone's gone. That didn't make sense to me until I saw Basetrack.
Okay.
Yeah. What that experience is like for family members.
For the people back home. Yeah.
Not until I saw that show. So I think more of those shows are will be valuable too.
Well, we are pro that.
Yeah.
We are pro that. All right. Thanks a lot, Maurice.
All right. Thank you.
Okay. And we're back with some recommendations for you. I think we're mostly New York theater based. Is that the...
Today we are.
Okay. All right. Well, Russ, what do you have there? You saw something last night which you liked.
Yes. I'm recommending The Light Years at Playwrights Horizons, created by the Debate Society. It's a really fun piece. It's running through April. It hasn't opened yet. So I can't give a review, but I will say it's definitely worth seeing. A lot of great use of the space and strong performances. A lot to do with the electricity and light, and audience really feels involved, and so it's worth catching.
And color and light.
Color and light.
Just give me a tease on my
recommending. I may too. I'm seeing it today.
What are you recommending?
I'm not so much recommending a show, but I'm recommending a concept or giving some people something to think about.
Good.
So I saw Everybody by Brandon Jacob Jenkins at the Signature last week. Nice. It's running until March 19th. Brandon's one of their resident playwrights, so he'll be doing all of the things with them the next couple of years. But Everybody in particular is a modern retelling of a 16th, mid-millennia morality play about death and the things you take with you when you die and the things you leave behind. And the structure is really interesting, like a bunch of actors. It's like basically one person plays everybody who, you know, who has to figure out what they can take with them when they die. And there's a bunch of actors at the beginning of the show who draw their roles from it. So a different actor will play everybody every night. Does that make sense?
You know, yes. Everybody is a little bit of a, like a Who's on First pun there. So it's almost all the actors in the show, from what I've read, almost all of them. There's a few who only play one part all the time.
Yeah.
But all the other ones, I don't know how big the cast is. They alternate. They draw their roles from a half, much like that Shotgun Hamlet, where it's like, and so they've all memorized all the roles, and they're all going to play different roles depending on the night.
Yes. Just to get across the concept that, you know, everybody dies, basically. But it's not so much the show itself, which I had some mixed feelings about, which I will not get into. It's about this thing that Brandon's doing that I find really interesting, which is like reinventing classics, like very obscure, problematic classics, and making it relevant to people today. Like, he did the same thing with Octoroon, which is based on Busico's Octoroon, and it's being done around the country. So, you know, go see Octoroon. It's amazing. It's the best thing ever. But I find it interesting because, like, he's taking these works, which if you put it up as is today, it would be like the Big River Review, but like times 10.
Right.
Instead, like, he's using some of the dialogue from the real play and then putting an extra level of meta commentary on relating to contemporary events / life, and using that to make these classics resonate in a new way to audiences. I don't know if anyone else is doing it quite like that. Mm-hmm. And so I think this is more me like encouraging theaters to fuck it, like play with raw text.
We can say fuck
more
with it. We can fuck with the text. Cornerstone did a Every Man in the Mall about 10, 15 years ago. That was I didn't see it, but it was a retelling of Every Man with a multicultural cast, and it's a 1501 morality play. And I don't
called
know
Every Man, every but now man, it's everybody.
Everybody. Yes. Well, that's good. I'm hoping to see that. So speaking of New York and speaking of plays living in the moment, Sunny in the Park with George, this production you might have heard of, starring Jake Gyllenhaal, this new revival.
Who?
Yeah, exactly. And Annalee Ashford, who is really the show's secret weapon. I am a huge Sondheim head, but I have often ranked this show lower because the second act has always bothered me. And I've never been a big fan of the song putting it together. And I'm still not a big fan of the song, but this revival knocked me out. And I would just say, you know, having two wonderful, sympathetic performers doing a new take on these roles and having such a strong emotional bond, it really is a story about their relationship all the way through from the beginning to the end. Which, of course, all the claims people make for this play about being about art versus love and all those themes are always clear to me. I get what your point is. It never hit me emotionally until this production. So I would... Annalee Ashford especially, it's such a shame that she's not going to be eligible for Tony nomination, because I don't really care about Tonys, but it's but the politics...
I would like her to get one.
But she is so good.
We don't care about them, but probably she does.
So,
Sherry has one, right?
I don't know. For Kinky Boots? Yeah, we need our Tony database is not here. In any case, so maybe she already has one. In any case, her version of Children in Art, anyway, I don't want to oversell it since you're about to see the show today. I would just say...
But actually for the listeners, you can't see it. Like, how do they fix the second act?
They don't fix the second act. They just do the second act really well.
But what do they do well about it?
Well, okay, so they keep the emotional through line so strong. And also, I would say the chromalume, okay? It's a gimmick. it's never worked for me. It's always been ridiculous. I mean, the character of George, the great grandson in the second act, is still basically just a concept, more of a concept than a character. Mm-hmm. And he's basically, it's not a spoiler to say he basically becomes a ghost of George. He basically is George from the first act. So he's still a very thin conception, but he's so fully embodied in this production. And Jake Gyllenhaal's, he's no Manny Patinkin, but he's a fine singer. And he's just, again, he can really act, that kid, It's like if the acting is strong and the relationship is strong, I mean, there's songs that never hit me as hard. Like Everybody Loves Louie, that's a fine song. I was crying by that song because it's so clearly a song about how she loves George, right? Yes. And how she still loves George. I mean, and that's obvious. Again, these are not new revelations you would get from reading the score or hearing it, but the way it hits you emotionally, again. Also, the conductor, I think his name is Chris Fenwick. I hope I get that right. He deserves a Tony in himself. The music is, nothing is overplayed. Everything is, I think that's the other thing, is this first act does not knock you over like it usually does. And then the second has a letdown. Everything is just kind of at this great level. Like, it doesn't come out of the gate like, wow, Sunday in the Park with George. It's just like, this is it. This is the score.
It's like a steady tone.
It's a steady tone. And I think it's sort of, I mean, I don't know if it's calculated. I don't know if. And what's interesting to me is that this is directed by James Lapine's daughter, Sarna, who's, I don't know.
Niece.
Oh, niece. Okay, I thought it was his daughter.
Niece.
Okay, well, that changes everything. No, but she's related to him, and she doesn't have that many credits.
Right.
And she directed this as an encore staging, right? Wasn't this encores last year? This
was originally encores, yeah. Yes.
So, yay for encores. We're giving them some love.
love and hate.
Anyway, and it's magnificent. It is the second revival on Broadway right now running with the orchestra on stage, but with the other one being Sunset Boulevard. But this one, knocks that one out of the park,
and
so to speak.
Annalee Ashford does have a Tony for You Can't Take It With You, so you can feel less bad about it.
I don't feel so bad, although she deserves it for this. I mean, again, I can't say enough about how much those performances work.
It's all Jake Gyllenhaal's fault that she can't get a Tony.
I guess because of the short run, right?
Yeah, because if it was someone else.
Yeah, when I went into it, I thought, well, gosh, this show could sell without him. It's like, and it probably could, because it's a good enough show. And there are so many great musical theater actors who aren't movie stars who could do this part really well.
Right.
Though I'd love to see. Have we seen Raul Esparza do the part? I mean, there's so many people.
But I think he's done it before.
He's done it, but not on Broadway. Anyway. Yeah. But I will say there is something special about these two. There is really is something magic about it. Anyway.
Extension?
I think it should be filmed. Someone should film this thing, Right?
Cary Fukunaga should film this thing.
Who's Cary Fukunaga?
He filmed the Finishing the Hat, the video of Jake Gyllenhaal singing Finishing the Hat. And he's also Golden Globe winning film director.
I'm not familiar with this video.
True Detective.
Of Jake Gyllenhaal singing. Oh. Well, we'll link to that.
Yeah, I'll send it to you.
And on that note, I think we've spoken a very, very long time. Another great show. Links will be on this page. Rate us on iTunes. Helps people find us, right?
Yeah. Rate us on all of the apps. We're on Stitcher and Google Play.
Okay.
And one last thing about the Light Years. If you like theater about theater, the famous theater maker Steele Mackay, who allegedly created the folding theater seat, invented the folding theater seat, is a major character in the play.
On that note, we'll close. That's amazing. All right.
Oh my God, facts.
Facts.
Okay. See you at the theater.
All right.